Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and practiced on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. High Truths is more than a podcast. It's a movement to unite physical, mental, and addiction health. It brings innovations to connect public health, public safety, and prevention. Our discussions inspire people to implement programs that save lives. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a 5-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Drug Free America Foundation, tackling the pervasive issue of substance use and its far-reaching impacts on individuals, families, and community. Drug Free America is supporting ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors and scientists educating on the harms of marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a prevention conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Prevention science is the application of a scientific methodology that seeks to prevent human dysfunction before it occurs. Prevention research looks for risk factors to avoid and protective factors to enhance. And prevention works. The United States showed incredible prevention success with tobacco. 47% of Americans were smoking in 1963, and today only 11% smoke. We have proven prevention success with various drug and alcohol interventions as well. Today, more than ever, young people are making the decision to protect their brain and not use alcohol, tobacco, or drugs until at least age 21, and I would hope for age 25 or 27, when the brain is fully grown. Prevention can be universal, a strategy that applies to an entire population. For example, making cigarettes very expensive to discourage use. Prevention can also be selective, targeting a high-risk population. Let's take kids with a family history of addiction and teach them life skills to prevent drug use way early in grade school. And prevention can be indicated. Indicated prevention for diabetes is screening people with lab work that have pre-diabetes and applying an intervention. And similarly, people can be screened for having pre-addiction without an existing substance use disorder and apply an intervention. Prevention occurs at the individual, family, and community and society level. We won't arrest our way out of drugs. We won't treat our way out. We won't naloxone our way out, but we can prevent our way out. To learn more about prevention, I reached out to Carlton Hall. Carlton Hall is president and CEO of Carlton Consulting. He consults for communities, organizations, families, and individuals in intensive substance abuse prevention. His experience made him one of the most highly sought-after instruction and guides across the nation and internationally. To learn more about Carlton Hall, check out the High Truth show notes. I recorded this conversation with Carlton on February 21, 2025. Carlton Hall, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Wonderful. You know what? I kept seeing you like all over the world, from like Vienna and Florida, DC. It doesn't matter where there you were. And it's like, wait a second, I got to have you on this show.
Well, I appreciate it. That's the more preferred response. But yes, I really enjoyed meeting up with you when we could meet up, and always enjoyed the conversations that we had. And so, yeah, I'm looking forward to this one.
Yes. And yeah, it's always inspiring. We like to talk to each other and get ideas, and it's inspiring. But I want to start with your background, as I do with all the guests. But you have your own consulting firm. We have see that beautiful logo in the background. Tell us about how did that come about?
So I've been involved with the substance use prevention field for now getting close to 30 years now, actually.
How did you get into it?
That's interesting. I'm born and raised in the city of Philadelphia, and was really in corporate America for a bit after college, and it was a tragedy that came to my family. My cousin, whom I had helped to come from Chicago simply because there were challenges with gangs in the area that he was living at the time, brought him to Philadelphia, helped him to get a job. He was mistaken for someone that was a part of another drug gang in Philadelphia. He wasn't involved with anything at all. He was coming from work, and someone thought that he was transporting money. And that turned into a tragic murder that really shook me and shook my family. And it brought my attention to the issues and the challenges that are impacting upon many in our communities around this issue. And that was actually the beginning of my interaction and engagement and involvement with what can we do and how can we help inform folks to better protect them as it relates to these issues and these situations. And so that's actually where and how I got my start. That led to the establishing of a nonprofit that I had in Philadelphia called the Strong Foundation, in which what I did is I helped provide support and capacity building services to organizations and agencies that were trying to help support young people, particularly those to stay away from the drug trade. From there, the city of Philadelphia brought me in, and I was a part of the mayor's office of community services there in the city of Philadelphia, which I served as the crime and public safety liaison for the city. And that got me involved. And it was at that point in time that I came into contact with Drs. Hawkins and Catalano, who established a framework called the Communities That Care framework. And I was the first to bring that framework of prevention into the city of Philadelphia. And it received a good bit of attention, and we were able to help diffuse that throughout the state of Pennsylvania at the time, and then much more broadly. And that was really my foray into the application of prevention science. And from there, things just kind of grew, where I learned from, oh my goodness, literally everyone that I came into contact with, including many of our common friends, such as Bob DuPont, who we were both together at a event celebrating him not too long ago, and others. Too many teachers for me to name, but throughout it all, I've had the remarkable experience of working in every state in our country, many counties in every state in our country, and almost every territory, as well as internationally, promoting the application of prevention science, because I saw that as one of the most viable ways in which to be able to help stem the challenges that are associated with substance misuse and abuse around our country. It was just the way I found to address the severity of the issue that we all are caring so much about.
Yeah, and the legacy of your cousin lives on through you and your work.
I think about him every day.
Yeah, it does. It continues to drive that. So you've been around for a while, and dealing in prevention science. How have you seen the field evolve, or de-evolve? I think we're not having as much attention on it now as we did maybe when you started, or is that just a perception?
Well, I would say that there's some good news and bad news associated with all of this, and I think mostly good, and I share that because I think we are living in a time where we know more than we've ever known before. We have more information than we've ever had before. We know more about what works than we've ever had before. I'm optimistic about the ways in which we've been able to effectuate change that's been positive across our nation. We are seeing more and more and more young people abstaining from substance use and experimentation than we've ever had since we've been tracking this information and numbers. And that's not happening by accident. That's happening because we've been intentional about this. So prevention is indeed working. That being said, we are dealing with an evolving landscape and emerging issues and challenges across the nation that I know you are extraordinarily familiar with, whether we're talking about the opioid epidemic and crisis, which to me is much more about a crisis and an epidemic of polysubstance misuse that's going across our nation. Well, that's happening at the exact same time as we are having this extraordinarily confusing conversation around legalizing and commercializing THC across our country, while at the same time the highest number of overdoses are taking place, while at the same time we're hearing a growing swell of voices in our nation attempting to convince the country that hallucinogens should be seen and perceived and thought of as medication. And we've heard that we've seen that movie before, so to speak. All of that's happening. We have new psychoactive substances that we are contending with. And so while we now know more than we've ever known before, particularly from a prevention and the application of prevention science, we are dealing with a changing and ever-changing landscape, which is requiring us to continue to figure out how to navigate that, how to ensure that we are applying the science well enough to be able to mitigate the harms that are associated with it. And so we are living in what I believe Dr. King would have referred to as a very fiercely urgent now, right? These are things that we are confronted with, and he would go on in that phrase and talk about the fact that there is such a thing as being too late if we are too complacent. And so much of what I see as the charge that I've had and that my company takes on is to help make folks aware that this time is a time of urgency, that we are in a fiercely urgent time, and that our the things that we are seeing are not happening by accident. Our communities are perfectly engineered to produce the results we are currently seeing. These are things that we can actually do something about. We don't have to just accept this as normal. And so that's what it is that I'm seeing. That's how I see, how prevention has evolved over time. I remember when prevention was almost exclusively about being scared straight, so to speak, and scare tactics and the like. And now it is a robust science, and we know how to apply that science in ways that are empowering communities to effectuate change. And we are indeed seeing some great results as a result of that.
That's great. And we could talk a little bit more in details about that. The last time that I saw you was just a few days ago in Florida. We were
good to see you again.
Yes, I know. we were at the National Prevention Summit in St. Petersburg, Florida. And the title of your keynote talk was Transformational Leadership in Prevention. And you had this cutest little picture of your cutest grandson, you know, trying to get through this gate that's like blocking the stairs. Adorable. And I learned that he calls you Babu. So that's just, that's adorable too.
Babu. Yes, indeed.
Babu. So Babu, tell me about that picture and how that applied to your talk about prevention and leadership.
So I talked earlier about the fact that I have learned from innumerable giants in our field and have benefited from being mentored by so many. My greatest teachers, to tell you the truth, are my grandchildren. Ronit, about 8 years ago, just about eight, it'll be eight come this March, my son and his wife gave us our first grandchild, my grandson, Ethan, who you saw the picture of. And then 10 days later, my daughter gave birth to twins, which meant we went from zero to three in 10 days. And I share that simply to talk to you about how radical that was to my life.
What a blessing. Isn't it the best?
It is the absolute, absolute best. And I will share with you that I had no idea that it would affect me the way it affected me, right? Those grandchildren became everything to me. And because my son is who he is, he couldn't stand that his younger sister had two and he only had one. So we now have four grandkids. I shared a picture of Ethan trying to being blocked by a gate, a childproofing gate at the top of the stairs. And I shared that because I noticed that when I would go to their home, even though I have a couple of degrees, for the life of me, I couldn't figure out how to open up that doggone thing and navigate the stairs. And there were other things. There were plugs in the outlets. There were locks on cabinets in the kitchen, and the like. And what I learned from my grandchildren is that it totally reframed for me the way I view prevention and the work that we do. And what it showed me is that prevention is really, truly about identifying the most vulnerable within our community. Just as that gate was not for me, but it was indeed for the most vulnerable in the context of that environment. And identifying the areas, the places that place them at greatest risk, where they have the highest degree of vulnerability, such as the top of the stairway is an invisible vulnerability that needed to be made blatantly obvious. And in our society, there are those that are highly vulnerable that we need to prioritize. And because substance use does not affect everyone equally. Substance misuse, there are those that have a greater vulnerability to addiction that we can identify, we can help, and we can support. There are all kinds of reasons why that is. Those are what I would refer to as invisible vulnerabilities that need to be made blatantly obvious, just like that gate at the top of the stairs represents that. And I use that as an analogy just simply to help those of us that are dedicated in this field to recognize our role is to do three things. It is to make the invisible visible, right? take those invisible vulnerabilities and make them blatantly obvious so that folks could understand the importance of it in the context of our society. If there are things such as, we look at what's taking place with the marijuana and cannabis industry right now. I'm simply going to share that I believe that there are a number of invisible vulnerabilities that we need to make blatant and obvious, such as potency, right? In large measure, large part, our community, our society is not having the conversation that they ought to be having around the potency of THC within our society. The fact that delivery methods, right? Folks aren't aware that when you change the delivery of any substance, typically the use of that substance goes up. Well, the delivery methods and mechanisms that are associated with the substance misuse aligned with THC has made it almost impossible to keep pace with how much the access has been able to be increased.
And by delivery, do you mean vaping, edibles, shatters, dabs, or that you can call a quick, you know, text a number and have it delivered to your door?
Both and. The delivery methods and mechanisms such as concentrates, such as vaping, all of that, folks don't understand how simply because that is a part of a process. Those things didn't exist before. They now exist. And we are seeing huge numbers of marijuana use disorder taking place within our country that is going virtually unknown and unheard of, except for those who are kind of in this work and in this field. We need to get it out. And beyond that, but also the fact that the methods by which folks can access this now is on your cell phone, right?
Yeah.
You no longer have
your
to
phone,
go.
Your phone is a drug dealer.
You don't have to go into, it used to be that, it was the dark trench coat. You would go in the back alley. You know, there are these ideas in which, you would have to go out of your way. Place yourself at risk. Not anymore. Your cell phone is by which you're able to do this. And so the fact of the matter is what I'm sharing is that most in our society are not aware that that is the case.
And by the way, just for our listeners, when you say that, your phone is, or say the phone is your drug dealer, it's not just for the kids who are getting a Xanax or Adderall or whatever. A staggering statistic is online pharmacies that only, 5% of online pharmacies are following the rules, and people have died going online to what they think is a legitimate pharmacy and getting fentanyl.
It is ridiculous. My best friend, we just marked in the 1 year anniversary of his son's death in Philadelphia, who by all accounts thought he was just getting an edible that just something that he was getting, and of course there was fentanyl found in what he had purchased. That was, black market and the like. And folks don't understand that that is a part of what has become normalized in our society. And I share with you, going back to the story of my grandchildren and what they shared with me, what they taught me is simply this, is that normalization equals invisibility. The fight that I'm in is not merely a fight against addiction or a fight towards sobriety or a fight against the illegal misuse of drugs, but it is a fight against normalization. When you normalize something, you render that thing invisible, right? There are things, I'm in New York City right now. You can go downtown Manhattan and see these weed trucks. And tables all over. I'm sure you've seen them. They look very, very much like the Good Humor or the Mr. Softy ice cream trucks that we would come up. And they work the exact same way. Brightly colored. They have music blaring to attract attention. There is a window in the side of the truck.
It probably was an ice cream truck. They bought an ice cream truck and made it a weed truck.
It is exactly the case. I was walking in Manhattan and this lovely young lady stuck her head out as I walked by the truck. And she said these words to me directly. She said, "Hey guy, don't be shy. Come get high. I got your candies. I got your lollipops. I got your gummies. Don't be shy. Come get high." Right?
I bet you they weren't checking ID.
What was impressive is at the time that that had happened for me, this is a number of years that I actually had that experience. They've been in this thing now forever. At the time that that had happened, recreational use was not legal in the state. And so that truck was actually not selling anything that had a THC value that would get anybody high, right? There was nothing on that truck that would get anybody, give anybody any kind of a buzz or any kind of a high. They couldn't do it, right? But that was not the purpose of that truck. The purpose of that truck was not to get anybody high, get everybody high. The purpose of that truck was to normalize the truck, was to normalize that this is something that we can have in our society. And it wasn't too much longer than recreational use was indeed made legal here in New York. And now what would have been a very rare sighting and even a jarring sighting some 10 years ago or such, even in New York City, is now very, very much commonplace. And not only do you have those trucks, but you actually have street vendors. You have folks that are selling things on tables and the like. And that is not unique to New York City. It is simply stating that when you make something invisible, it becomes normalized. And that the, or rather saying that the other way, when you normalize something, it becomes invisible. Folks are just walking by it. Children are walking by it. Families are walking by it. I'll never forget the young lady that when I was walking by that truck, who was holding her young son in her hand, and the son is saying, "Oh, mommy, 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 can I have a lollipop? Can I have a gummy bear?" While we were walking by that truck. My point being is that the job that we all have is to make the invisible visible again, to make sure that we are putting that gate at the top of the stair in terms of that throughout our society.
Unnormalize it, right?
To denormalize it is exactly what it is that we should be doing.
I've seen that in the medical community with the opioid prescription epidemic, right? Yeah. We had patients coming in, it's like, okay, I ran out of my prescription or I lost my prescription or I need more or my doctor's out of town. And that was a normal, and we would just refill the prescriptions and roll our eyes. And it took a while. That was normal, right? And it took a while to undo that, to say, no, this is not good.
Yeah.
This is not healthy. Exactly. We had to hear that from the outside, really. We didn't do that internally. Someone, a higher authority, had to say, this is not good. We need to change. And gave the tools to change.
Yeah, and regrettably, I would share that that only changed as a result of the fact that we were hit by innumerable deaths that was happening at the as the cause. So there was devastating effects and impacts.
Right. And it was devastating. There were, I remember when I was talking about that, I was looking at my old slides and I was saying, we have 100 deaths a day. And now when I give my lectures, it's like, those were the good old days, because now we have 300 deaths a day.
Isn't that crazy? It seems like we were doing similar presentations and talks because I could track it. I can remember when we were saying it was 50 deaths a day. And then the next year we would see it and we would talk about 100, plus deaths. And then the next year it would be 150 plus deaths. And then we're well up over 200, close to 300 deaths a year. And to the degree that we, regrettably, I think, and this is again part of what it is that I believe our charge is, and part of what I was trying to relate in my talk the other day, is the responsibility, the accountability upon all of us to understand that we have to raise the alarm. We have to be the ones to engage others in this conversation of change. That we have to go and reach beyond ourselves to bring the broader population into this conversation of change. But the onus is upon us to do it. It's not going to happen by just waiting for the folks to see it and to care about it in the same way that some of us who are closest to it do.
And I know you work with communities, and the power, just hearing you say that reminds me, that's probably why I like the prevention community so much, because they reached out to me years ago saying, hey, you're a nice doctor, why are you guys prescribing so much? And I'm like, because I'm told to do so, that is our norm. But they really got me thinking and got me into that prevention mentality that, that I'm with throughout this day, not just for drugs, but also any patients, right? You fell down. Well, how do we prevent you from falling down again? It's easy to fix your hip, but let's make sure it doesn't happen again. But that's local community reached out to, this, lowly doctor, and really made me who I am today. A lot of things can happen locally.
Yeah, well, I have to add to their appreciation to Dr. Lev. Your work has been extraordinary, and extraordinary to those of us in this field. And you have a remarkable capacity, a remarkable gift of translating things in ways that our folks can understand it and get it and hear it and really be able to see their relationship to it. I love hearing your talks. I love the way in which you are able to take some things that are really complex and kind of heightenedly emotional things, but make them palatable for folks to be able to get it, because that's the way we engage folks outside of our field. That's how we go outside of academia. That's how we go outside of our hospitals. That's how we go outside of our work and engage the broader population into this conversation of change. The community is absolutely needed to be able to make this take place. I think that we have to do a few things better. We have to, in my view, become clearer. Because I think there's a lot of confusion as to what does it mean for folks to be involved with prevention.
Can you explain that? What do we need? Bring clarity to the need for clarity.
The challenge that I have is the fact that in the prevention field and in the work that we've done, we've gotten really, really good at talking about the what's we can do. We have 6 phases of this and 5 steps to do that. There are a bunch of frameworks that we found that is extraordinarily helpful, all of them extraordinarily valuable. I've had the privilege of working with many of the developers of some of these, some of the science that we now know and see as vital. The challenge, though, is that in large measure are attempts to diffuse that, you know, through our communities and to our communities, typically through either some federal grant programs or the like. It can almost seem doctrinal, right? And folks just kind of say that this is kind of the latest thing that we need to do, is the latest thing that we're told to do because we have this grant to be able to do it. My point being is that the typical person in our society could care less about what your grant is, could care less about what frameworks are, could care less about the principles and the application of prevention science, risk factors, protective factors, social development strategies, and the like. They want to know, how can I do something that's going to make my child safer today, tomorrow, than they are today? They want to be able to engage in that way. And so I suggest we have to become clearer with respect to who we are and what is it we do and why we do what we do. That's what I'm talking about there. Secondly, we have to help folks focus locally, right? To leverage, understand that these issues and these challenges, while they show up everywhere, there's a difference in the way of substance misuse looks, feels, and the impact of it in, let's just say, North Central Philadelphia, than it is in Clinton County in Arkansas, for example, or in Maine or others. My point being is that we have to help local communities become the local problem solvers for the issues that are taking place there. And we have to become astute in how to be able to do that. And then lastly, we have to be able to learn how to leverage what is it that we know actually works in order to be able to move the needle at the population level. I'm a preventionist, hardcore preventionist, honey. That means that I believe three things. I believe that the best way of addressing any issue or any problem is to prevent that problem before it starts. I believe in the full engagement and the full empowerment of the community in both their role of helping us to understand the context of the problem, but also being a part of the solution to that problem. And lastly, I believe in being able to effectuate change at the population level by applying science, to be guided by science in order to do that. I believe in those three things. And I don't think that there's anybody that's out there that would have any disagreement or any challenge with that. The problem is that most folks are not involved with that. And so that's upon us. How do we make sure that folks who believe what we believe are brought into this process of change?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it works historically, right? If you look at, you know, we always say, you know, the war on drugs, and we're not going to arrest our way out. We're not going to treat our way out. We're not going to naloxone our way out. But we actually can prevent our way out.
That's exactly right.
We can prevent our way out. We did that with tobacco. We did it with prescription opiates. And you know, we could do it again. What I see happening is that we don't have enough of you, right? Of that voice has been shifted to supply, which is important, absolutely. And, you know, treatment, once you have a disease, that's what I do as a doctor, right? But again, I'd rather have you like not fall next time and not have this problem, right?
It is absolutely true, which means we have to continue to beat the drum with respect to the importance and the value of prevention. As I mentioned before, become clearer about prevention to help ensure that folks understand what is it that we're talking about. We referenced just a little bit ago about the fact that we are living in a time where close to 300 deaths a day are kind of the statistic, and that's likely to change, you know, when we look at it in another few months from now, around that, but that's where we are. And we often use the analogy of a commercial plane airline crashing on a daily basis, right? And kind of wouldn't that jar us to immediate collective action around that? We often use that. My challenge with respect to that is that not only are we talking about a commercial airline crashing every day, but we're talking about a commercial airline crashing every day and then another 300 people getting in line to take that exact same flight tomorrow, every single day, right? And so part of what it is that we have to do, we have to do the search and rescue. We have to do all the things that are necessary in order to save as many lives as possible. We have to do that. And the investment in that is absolutely appropriate. But if we don't start paying attention to the folks that are standing in line and do something about the line, then we're going to continue to see this problem exist. And so my goal is to enlist as many folks as possible as we have these conversations across the nation and internationally to lock arms, to be able to say, hey, let's pay attention to that. Let's see if we can address these issues smarter and help our communities become smarter faster as a result of that. And so that's what it is that
it works, right? It's not just, hey, let's do a program. We actually have results.
We have that. As I shared before, we now know more than we've ever known before. And it's promising and inspiring. And I'm it's optimistic. I'm grateful for what it is that we can do. And for what we've been able to achieve. We've actually seen some great data that shows that substance misuse among our high school age youth are going in an extraordinarily positive direction, with the exception of marijuana and cannabis, as we know. We have some real challenges with respect to that, and with respect to vaping. Vaping is also going in an unwanted direction.
What are some good examples of prevention, programs that need to be happening?
Absolutely. I mean, there are a number of things that we understand. We understand that if we're able to help parents understand their role and provide them with the tools that are necessary to be able to work with and speak to and engage with their children throughout the growth and the development of their brains, we are then able to help minimize. If we engage folks with parents and meaningful adults, we're able to help.
I love that slide that Bertha Madras, Dr. Madras, had on her thing, where she had parents who say, no, I do not approve of drugs. I don't want you to use anything. Their kids, they're are most likely not to use. And kids who are like, well, maybe, well, whatever, or blasé, or if, their kids use more, and parents who use, their kids use more, right? So
that's exactly right. And it's not that it's not that it works every time and for all kids, but the more parents that are equipped and empowered and supported, the greater the likelihood is of young people making different choices and different decisions as they go through life. So that's one. The organizing of community, the bring together of these multi-sectors of all the key stakeholders, getting them to see a problem in a common way, understanding their shared relationship and relevance to addressing that problem, and then providing support, such as the Drug-Free Community Support Program that is overseen by the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. That program has been a huge boon to prevention. We've seen, and the evidence is clear. Communities that have these drug-free coalitions in place are, when compared to communities that do not have them, are having profound differences in the results of that. And so that's another example of addressing kind of some of the environmental issues and challenges that affect substance misuse levels within our society. Those programs that engage young people as peer educators and supporters also have profound impacts and effect. I love the Institute for Behavior and Health. Dr. Bob and Caroline DuPont and Corinne Shea, their work with this campaign called One Choice, in which they engage young people in schools across the nation to agree to delay substance use of all types until after the age of 21. That sounds, that sounds preposterous. Right? That sounds like totally unrealistic.
But it works.
And the data actually shows that the largest majority of our young people are doing exactly that.
Yeah.
Right? And so they're the norm, right? Except society has a different perception. So we have to engage in that. So increasing the volume and the exposure of efforts like those kinds of programs, I think, are...
Is that what you're talking about, like prevention influencers?
Yeah. That's indeed a perfect example of what it means to be a prevention influencer, a term I coined a number of years ago based upon a conversation that I had with my daughter. As a matter of fact, when I was trying to get into what is this influencer thing that seems to be going on, here's the fact of the matter. As you might be able to tell, I've been around for a little while, right? The color of the hair on my chin and top of my head might give that away.
I guess men coloring their hair doesn't work as good as for me.
it wouldn't matter at all. It wouldn't matter at all. And so my point being is that if we are actually talking about preventing young people from engaging in these behaviors in the first place, a guy that's over 60, that, you know, Even if I know some of the local, some of the newer phrases and the like, I'm probably not the best communicator to young people around these issues and these challenges. I can come out there and talk all I want about the dangers of high potent THC to them, but if we engage young people, provide them with the information, give them the tools, and then just get out of the way. I tell everybody, if you don't know the latest TikTok dance, just get out of the way and let them do it. They would do a much better job than any of us would at being able to engage folks in this process of change.
I love that. I love that prevention influencer. Is that what, and you have a, is it that you have this leadership, youth leadership and advocacy training?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And really proud to say that my son oversees it for us. He's a vice president at Girard College in Philadelphia and has spent his entire career educating youth, working with them, and does a much better job than I do of engaging with them at their level and matching their energy, so to speak.
Yeah, that's great. Well, good for you, Carlton. When your kids copy you, that's the best compliment.
It was a great feeling. It was a great feeling. We were just together at the National Prevention Network, the NPN conference, not too long ago. So yes, it was a great feeling. And he's actually been with me internationally. He's helped me to convey that message when we were in Vienna.
Yeah, I saw him in Vienna.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. And so yes. I say you go forth and you do that, And let me know whenever you want me to show up. But he does a phenomenal job with that.
That's awesome. And well, since we're talking about Vienna, something else that you're doing, you've been, like you said, been to all 50 states in your prevention work, but you'll say prevention is global. And you're here with me today because your trip to Kenya was canceled. So tell me about some of your, how is things different and the same in the terms of prevention in other countries? I imagine that we as Americans, this superpower, our threats are greater. We have more fentanyl deaths. We have more commercialized THC and psychedelics that in a way that would make prevention harder for us than in other ways. But I don't, tell me about your perspective.
Sure. Well, to that point, I would simply say that we have the greatest level of demand in the United States, of any nation in the world.
Do we have the greatest amount of supply too?
I think it's a combination of the two, because I think they're interrelated. I think the supply is meeting the demand and vice versa. And both are influencing each. And in both cases, the United States far outpaces every other nation in terms of that, which means that the vigilance that we have to have is far greater. In other countries,
We did a great job with tobacco. You go to any other country and everybody's smoking away everywhere, and here we don't have that. We kind of fixed that. I mean, it's nothing perfect, but we have least tobacco use. So we've shown that we can fix things when we want to.
That's exactly right, which is why our voice is so important, which is one of the reasons why for a good while, I would say that we were looked to with a good deal of regard with respect to kind of, okay, if this is working in the United States, can we then have some version of that for our country, which is part of what helped to precipitate my being able to start to engage with other countries. It was the fact that we had something to say. We had science that worked that was not being employed in other nations. Every country, and as you know, every continent has different challenges and different issues. But what I would say is some of the biggest cause for concern, two things. One is the fact that areas that were not and had not traditionally been high use areas, in which there was a great deal of issues because of misuse, as a result of trafficking and being a partner associated with these traffic lanes, the residual effect and impact of that has made use quite an issue and quite a challenge for a number of
people. What do you mean about trafficking? Are you talking about drug trafficking or human trafficking?
Drug trafficking, and we can have other conversations about the linkage between drug trafficking and human trafficking. You know, the criminal systems that are at play that involve both, usually engage with both, and those routes are somewhat similar. But you have routes that go from Afghanistan to and through and around Africa and to South America, through the Americas to the U.S. And the like. My point being, in areas such as I'll just point out Kenya, for example, Uganda, for example, which has this large port.
They don't have a fentanyl problem, right?
They don't have a typical fentanyl problem. They are indeed, though, experiencing high challenges with cocaine and heroin, and there has been some issues and challenges there in ways that I would say some 15, 20 years ago, it was not the case. And that's happening, and examples of that are happening across. So
do they have the Captagon, like the stimulants and hashish or cannabis?
Yes, there are growing numbers, and the data is supporting it. But part of the challenge in Africa and parts of Africa is their ability to collect information and collect data. But they're doing a much better job of that. And more to the point is that as a result of these rising issues and these rising challenges, need and desire to cooperate, to collaborate with those of us from the U.S. and those in Europe to try to bring some of that science to bear for their countries has increased, and you can see the capacity building happening in many of these countries, and which is why the Commission on Narcotics Drugs, the annual convening that you and I actually, I think we first met. I think it's so vitally important, because it's the one gathering in which all of these nations come together, and all the major kind of players that are trying to affect not only policy but also support and efforts and programs and change. All come together to learn with and from each other.
I remember there was a presentation by the African nations, and I think there was a statistics, you'll remember better than I did, that 25% of all of Africa are like less than 25 years old. And so this is...
That is exactly right. I don't remember the exact numbers,
but a percentage are youth. So the importance of, you know, preventing drugs on this population was great.
The flip side of that is that the lack of attention to that fact is also devastating their countries. And if they don't address that, which goes right back to the way we started our conversation, prevention has to be about identifying the most vulnerable within the context of our society, prioritizing them, and then identifying and prioritizing where they are most vulnerable. And that's what that data that they express really comes into play. They are among the youngest nations in our world, and have the greatest potential, but also the greatest vulnerability.
Right. And the other thing, when at the United Nations Commission, there were, I think, mostly American activists who wanted to normalize drug use, you know, push cannabis and other drugs. I remember their line was, "You have your wine, I'll have my line." Right. And the developing countries, you know, looking at that really and thinking, we can't afford that. We don't have, you know, MAT and buprenorphine and addiction, and other things. We have to prevent it before it starts. It's really unfair of the United States to be pushing that kind of an agenda on other nations when, you know, they don't have the equity to solve the addiction problem once it hits. Their main strategy is prevention.
Yes, you're exactly right, which is why prevention is so essential, as you just mentioned, to them, even from just merely a cost perspective. And it also is illustrative of the fight that we are in, and I will refer to it as that. There are indeed forces and agendas to help normalize substance use and substance misuse, and they are employing, many of them are very, very much supported financially in ways in which those who are trying to address and mitigate the harms of substance misuse are not. And so there is that kind of an imbalance. Internationally, folks are influenced by a number of things, including the amount of money that you're able to bring in to their communities. And so there's a great deal of folks influencing and trying to influence policy in these nations, which is why I believe that we have to counter that by employing what I refer to as prevention influencers in these nations. And it's one of the things that I'm most proud of. The good folks at the Colombo Plan have supported a training of young people internationally, and it's based in part, some portion of it, of that training is based in part in our work that we did in helping them to write the prevention influencer section of that curricula. And so throughout Africa and in parts of the Americas and throughout some Asian nations, one of the things that I'm just very, very proud of, even though I played just a tiny, tiny, tiny part in it, it is organized and overseen and supported by an extraordinary group of leaders and a team with Colombo Plan. But I am grateful to have played just a very small part in it, to see young people in all of these countries refer to themselves as prevention influencers, seeing that they it's their responsibility and taking it. It is one of the most amazing things. Just last year, I was there with the African Union's high level meetings that occurred in Zambia, and in this crowd where you had the heads of states and those that are the equivalent of our Secretary of State representing African nations. This young man who stood up and gave and delivered a speech, who referred to himself as a prevention influencer, addressing that large crowd, it was extraordinary. And that has happened time and time again in nation after nation. And so I share a few things. I think that there's a great deal of urgency. There's a lot that we have to be concerned about. There are definitely some things that are going in unwanted directions, and there are far too many things that have become far too normalized in our society. At the exact same time, I have never been more optimistic about where we are, about the fact that we have young people who are fully engaged in this campaign of change and see their relationship and the value of their voice in this process of change. And it allows me to feel like, you know what? I think we could feel comfortable and confident that we can pass the baton to some of these folks who are going to be able to take this and run much further and much faster than I've ever been able to do that.
That's awesome. Carlton Hall Consulting, who should be reaching out to you?
Oh, if you are attempting to work with your community in whatever level, whatever capacity, to mitigate or address the issues of substance misuse, and you think that there are ways in which we can help you build that capacity, please reach out to us. If we're not able to do it, we're definitely able to connect you with those who can. And so you can reach us through our website. We can provide a phone number, but we are here and available to you.
And your clients, are they communities, individuals, coalitions? Like, who should be
All of the truly, it's been all of the above.
We Country do of great, Kenya.
It truly has been all of the above. We've been very, very fortunate to be able to provide support at the national level and at state level and at the local level. And so, and we have a cadre of and a team of consultants, subject matter experts, who can speak to virtually any and every topical area that would touch the things that we're concerned about. And so we have the capacity and the ability to connect you with the appropriate resource to help and support you at whatever level that you happen to be at.
That's wonderful. Carlton, Babu, this has been such a wonderful conversation. Thank you. Like you said, we learned from so many people. I learned from you. I learned from all my guests. And I wish you luck. And I bet our paths will cross again.
I look forward to it. Anita, thank you so very, very much. Babu means grandfather in Swahili. And so whenever I hear it, I just feel a certain way. So thank you for that. That is the best title that I have, more than anything else.
Oh, it's the best.
So thank you so very, very much. And thank you for everything that you've done and the support that you brought to our nation, all the work that you've done at the national level and all the work that you continue to do advocating for the best of us. So we appreciate you and all that you do and look forward to any opportunity of engaging with you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Drug Free America Foundation. Visit dfaf.org and ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. That's IASIC1.org. High Truth producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.